are called phospholipids, right? That includes a phosphate group, which, if you look at your functional groups, the phosphate group has a negative charge on one of those four oxygens that are in the group. And so it's really beyond polar. It's fully charged, right? And therefore doesn't mind at all being around polar water. So that's why this bilayer forms. And that's how the original bags came to exist even before there was any life. Eventually, those became the first successful cells. But not until other things could be in this membrane. A functioning plasma membrane can't be purely phospholipids, because this is going to block certain things from getting through, and some of those things need to get through for a cell to remain alive. What kind of things are blocked, by the way? Things that are hydrophilic. Hydrophilic things are in the water, no problem, because they're hydrophilic, right? But hydrophilic means polar. Polar things out here don't want to be subjected to this thickness of the membrane where the hydrophobic tails are, because they are nonpolar, whereas the thing that I'm talking about, whatever it is polar. So polar things get excluded. And that's why you need other components of membranes in order to allow those polar things through. Slide 2 shows you examples of these other things I just mentioned that need to be members of the plasma membrane. It's not simply phospholipids. That's the main structure, the phospholipid bilayer. But here and there, all throughout the plasma membrane, all around the cell, you have various kinds of proteins, plus other components as well, but proteins are really important. And these are proteins that are doing different functions that we'll discuss, but they are membrane-bound proteins, right? They are part of the membrane. Although, I don't want you to be confused by the word membrane, by the phrase membrane-bound, because none of these molecules, because the protein is one molecule, a phospholipid is one molecule, another phospholipid is another molecule, and so on. None of these molecules is actually covalently bonded to each other. They're all individual molecules still, right? What holds the phospholipids in a pure phospholipid bilayer together is simply that avoidance of the tails from water. That's what holds them in place. They're not bonded, and so they can slip past each other. They're just in that position. And similarly, these proteins are not bonded. They're not tied to the phospholipids. What holds them in place is that a protein, remember, is a long strand of amino acids that has folded into some three-dimensional shape, right? But keep in mind the categories of biological amino acids. Some of them have polar R groups. Some of them have nonpolar R groups, right? And if you have a big protein, it's some mixture of polar and nonpolar amino acids if they're both used in the protein. So the polar ones are somewhere in the molecule. The nonpolar ones are somewhere in the molecule. In this example, notice this protein sticks all the way through the thickness. If you can't see its ribbon, but if you looked at its ribbon with all of its individual R groups, the nonpolar R groups would be in this region. The polar ones would be on both ends. And that's what keeps it there, kind of floating, like a buoy in water. If you imagine trying to push this thing so it would to try to get it out of the membrane, push it downward in the picture. Remember, this is polar R groups, which is why they don't mind being around the polar heads here. But if you try to push this through, you're going to expose these polar R groups of the protein to these nonpolar tails, and it's not going to like that. It's going to want to come back up, right? Similarly, if you try to push it up from the other end, it's going to expose these polar R groups to the nonpolar tails. And so it keeps it right in place, sticking all the way through the thickness of the phospholipid bilayer. But it's not covalently bonded to anything. Slide 3 is a cartoon of the two monolayers that make up the bilayer being separated. So just one layer of phospholipids is called a monolayer. The phospholipid bilayer is two monolayers. And there therefore is an exterior monolayer, which is labeled here the extracellular layer, and an interior one, which is in contact with the cytoplasm, that's the cytoplasmic layer. Right? And if you carefully freeze fracture this, meaning freeze the thing and then while it's frozen separate the two layers, which they can do carefully enough, you can see that the proteins, the dots on this photomicrograph, that are part of the membrane are more associated with the cytoplasmic layer, the interior layer, than they are with the exterior layer. That's why there's so many more dots here. And this makes sense because many of these proteins that are part of the membrane are doing jobs that for things that are happening inside the cell, so they need to be in contact with the cellular contents. Not all proteins stick all the way through the membrane, as we'll see. That brings us to 4. So now I want to introduce what is called the fluid mosaic model. That's not nearly dark enough. The fluid mosaic model of membrane structure. Well, first of all, just outside of biology, in everyday language, what is a mosaic? That's right. It's a piece of art that is made by using small pieces of something, like glass or tile or whatever, and you glue them to a surface, and that instead of paint, that makes the image. Fluid is the adjective of flow, meaning able to move around. That's why we call gases and liquids fluids. Fluid is not another word for liquid, by the way. Fluid can be either gas or liquid because it can flow, it can change its shape, whereas a solid can't. Fluid mosaic, therefore, refers to the fact that the phospholipids that make up a plasma membrane are not connected to each other, like I was saying before. They're just held in place, but they're still individual molecules that are able to move around with respect to each other. Here you see an edge view, but if you were to imagine looking at this from outside of the cell downward, you would see all those polar heads, like being in a skyscraper in Manhattan in New Year's Eve. You look down in Times Square and you see all the heads of the people that are getting drunk. Well, they aren't connected to each other either, right? So throughout the night, they're going to be in different positions. They're going to be shuffling around, but they're going to stay within the same street level, just like these are all staying within the same level of the monolayer. Well, most of them, I should say. So that's the fluid aspect of the mosaic. It's like a mosaic because each little head is like a piece of tile or glass in an artwork. But it's a fluid mosaic. It's not glued to the wall like an artwork is. Each tile or piece of glass is able to move around. And it might surprise you just how much movement there is occurring. This lateral movement, in other words, phospholipids that are next to each other switching places, occurs about 10 million times per second in every cell of your body. So that's just part of the fact that cells should never be thought of as unchanging devices. They are highly dynamic structures, always changing. It makes sense, though, that lateral movement is fairly easy, right? Because this lateral movement, staying within the monolayer and just switching places with other phospholipids, that doesn't change anything about exposing a polar to a nonpolar, right? It keeps the tails where they should be. It keeps the heads where they should be. You're just switching places. On the other hand, every once in a while, there can be a so-called flip-flop where a phospholipid in one monolayer switches with a phospholipid in the other monolayer. And the reason that is rare is, if you can imagine doing that, you're going to have to temporarily expose the head to this region, which it doesn't want to be, to get it down here, right? And that's why that only happens about once a month on average. So it's most of the movement is just movement within a monolayer, switching places. Membrane fluidity in the middle refers to how loose, how easily movable all this stuff is in the membrane. And so there can be very fluid membranes, really loose, or very tight membranes, viscous. Viscosity is resistance to pouring, right? Like maple syrup is much more viscous than water. So it's not nearly as loose. Well, that can be important because looseness or tightness of a membrane can affect how the cell operates, how the membrane operates for the cell. And as conditions change, that fluidity of the membrane can change. For instance, if it gets cold, everything's going to get tighter, right? It may be too tight. So in response to that tightening, a cell can adjust the kinds of phospholipids that are part of the membrane, because the membrane is not permanent. The cell adjusts it moment to moment. And it can make it looser, which would be appropriate in that instance. Or if it gets too hot, it could get too loose, so it would want to tighten it up by adjusting it. How it can adjust it is by loosening it, by putting in more and more phospholipids with kinks in their tails, which we've already explained for fats, those kinks are made if the fatty acid, which is each tail is a fatty acid, are unsaturated, right? If they're unsaturated fatty acids, they have the kink. So just like fats can be unsaturated, phospholipids can be unsaturated, and those tails with their bends makes them not pack together as tightly. So that would make it looser, which you would want to do if it's cold, for instance. On the other hand, if you make them out of nothing but saturated phospholipids, it's going to tighten it up. In animals, cholesterol is a major component of plasma membranes. We talked about cholesterol in the lipids section of the last chapter, or the two chapters ago. Remember, it's an animal product. Animals make cholesterol. Other organisms make similar sterols. But in us animals, cholesterol is important not only for the reasons I told you before, precursor to vitamin D and for all the steroid hormones. It also, though, is an important membrane component, and it can affect the fluidity as well to an extent, but also it affects the permeability to certain ions. It allows, how well ions go through is partially a function of how much cholesterol is embedded in there. As you can see in this cartoon version, cholesterol here and there can basically just fill in little gaps that would exist otherwise. All right, so that's the fluid mosaic model, and slide 5 is the results of an experiment to test whether that fluid mosaic model is actually true. Just like any science, a hypothesis has a corresponding prediction, and then you can set up an experiment to test whether that prediction comes true. Well, what they did here is take two different organisms, a cell from two different organisms, a mouse and a human. Each of them has proteins in their membranes, but being different species, they're different proteins. And through some special technique, they labeled them. They didn't get in there and color the magenta and purple, but they labeled them chemically so that they could tell them apart. And then they fused the two cells into one, so-called hybrid cell. Well, at that very moment of fusing the two, all of the mouse proteins are going to be on one side and all the human proteins are going to be on the other side. If the fluid mosaic model is not true, then you would expect them to stay in place. Right? In other words, come back later and still you'd have all the mouse proteins on one end and all the human proteins on the other end. But if the fluid mosaic model is true, if it is actually fluid and things are moving around, then later you should see exactly what they did see, which is both kinds of proteins have moved around and now they're equally distributed over the entire cell surface. Slide 6. Well, there's a lot going on in this picture, but the major thing I want to talk about here is that when it comes to proteins that are membrane-bound, part of the membrane, they have various jobs, but you can classify them just based on how they are associated with the membrane and nothing to do with their function. For instance, there are what are called peripheral proteins. A couple of them are labeled here. The periphery is the edge of something. So a peripheral protein is not in contact with any hydrophobic tails. It's just stuck to the heads on one monolayer. All right, so it's on the edge of the overall plasma membrane, in other words. That's why they're peripheral. And just like we've been talking about, they can move around. They'll still be connected to the heads somewhere, but they can move around as part of the fluid mosaic. Then there are proteins that are associated with the hydrophobic tails. In other words, I'm talking about ones that poke at least partially through the thickness. Peripheral proteins don't poke through the thickness. They're just on one surface. Well, unfortunately, they don't give you in this picture one example of something just poking like halfway through, but those exist. Whether it's halfway through or all the way through, if they are exposed to the tails and therefore are not peripheral, then they're called integral proteins. You have the label here. This is an integral protein. But it would be even if it were going halfway through as well. And integral means just part of the integrity. It's really part of the structure more than a peripheral protein is, which is just on the surface. So that's the two major categories based on the relationship of the protein to the membrane. There are peripheral proteins and there are integral proteins. But integral proteins include a subset of integral proteins, which is what all of these are that stick all the way through, and those are called transmembrane proteins. Transmembrane means across the membrane. It goes all the way through the thickness. So there, in any given transmembrane protein, there is part of that protein that is in direct contact with the extracellular fluid, and part of that same protein that's in direct contact with the intracellular fluid. That's what it means to poke all the way through. So put it another way, all transmembrane proteins are integral proteins. Right? But not all integral proteins are transmembrane. Some of them just poke some way through the thickness. There are also various things connected to the exterior surface of transmembrane proteins or even peripheral proteins on the outside. And you can see a bunch of hexagons here connected to them. Those you should recognize as monosaccharides that are hooked together. So these are polysaccharides that are connected to either proteins themselves or to phospholipids. So this thing is a glycolipid. Glyco means sugar, so it's a lipid with a sugar on it. This is a glycoprotein because it's a sugar connected to a protein. and those, the sugar part of those things, act more or less like little ID badges. In a multicellular organism, it's important for the various cells of the one individual to realize they are all cells of the individual and not foreign cells. So they wear these little ID badges that can be recognized by fellow cells of that same individual to not attack them, basically. Okay, 7. Here we have one polypeptide, which you can see because it's all one long ribbon, but it has a bunch of these alpha helices that I was talking about that's part of secondary structure, and then loops that aren't helices, and then another helix, and so on, for a lot of different helices that are arranged kind of like the wooden staves or the parts of a wooden barrel with a hollow interior. And so this is how a transmembrane protein can form a tunnel. This is a channel protein, as it's called. And so just the right kind of stuff is able to fit through that channel. But notice that because it's protein in all directions, all the way around the interior of that tunnel, whatever passes through this avoids all of these hydrophobic tails of the phospholipid bilayer. That's what I meant earlier when I said things that would normally be excluded from going through just a pure phospholipid bilayer because they are polar things, they can get through the cell, either into the cell or out of the cell, by going through tunnels and avoiding being in contact with those hydrophobic tails. Okay, 8. Let's look at 6 major functions, categories of functions, really, of membrane-bound proteins. So there's all kinds of membrane-bound proteins, but they do different jobs depending on what the protein is. First is transport, and this is what I was just talking about with the channel protein. That's one example of a transport protein. Proteins, though, that are part of the membrane and that act or that function to allow certain things through the membrane, either into the cell or out of the cell, collectively are called transport proteins. And there's different kinds, different categories, depending on what is being transported, how it's being transported, and so on. We'll talk about those in greater detail in a minute, but that's the transport function. Other proteins act as enzymes. Now, I've already talked about the importance of enzymes in general. A big fraction of the proteins that you're able to produce are enzymes because you need so many, since each individual reaction requires its own specific enzyme. Most of the enzymes are not membrane-bound. They are just inside the cell, operating where those reactions are taking place to catalyze those reactions. But some of them are actually part of the membrane. They're still doing exactly the same job. They're operating as a catalyst, so some substrate binds to them, gets turned into product, and then gets released. The fact that they're part of a membrane doesn't really change anything, but that's what some membrane-bound proteins are doing, actually, as enzymes. Signal transduction. Well, to transduce means to change from one form to another. For instance, a loudspeaker is an example of a transducer because you're converting an AC electrical signal into the mechanical movement of a cone, which pushes on the air, and that's why we hear it. It's converting it, though. It's transforming a signal. Here you have signal transduction for a cell, and what that refers to is the use of a chemical signal to cause something in the cell to happen that wouldn't without the signal being there. And the reason it's transduction is because the signal does not actually directly cause whatever the change is to occur. It's a chain of events. The signal causes something else to happen, which then causes something else to happen, and so on, until you finally have the result. Well, for the Hormones, which are signal molecules, they operate all over the body for various things, but hormones as one big category can be broken down into subcategories based on the chemical properties of those signal molecules, those hormones. Most of them are amino acid based, the protein hormones. And some of them are steroid hormones. Those are lipid based, right? Cholesterol is a lipid, and the steroid hormones come from cholesterol. The reason that we bother to put those into two distinct categories is because lipids are nonpolar, as we talked about. And therefore, the steroid hormones have no problem at all being around those phospholipid tails, and therefore the steroid hormones can go right through a plasma membrane and enter a cell. In fact, they can go right through the nuclear envelope and enter the nucleus. Now, keep in mind what I've said early on about signals. No signal has any effect unless and until it binds to a receptor of the right type with the right shape to receive it. So every signal has to have a receptor for it to do anything. The receptors, which are proteins themselves, for steroid hormones, ones that can get through the membrane, are inside the cell because the signal is going to enter the cell. But most of the hormones are protein hormones, and they therefore can't get through the membrane. They don't bind to receptors inside the cell because they wouldn't be able to get to them. Instead, they effectively knock on the door. So here you have this pie piece shaped signal molecule. Whatever, just imagine that's some sort of protein hormone, like insulin, for instance. In order for it to work, it has to have a receptor, since it can't get in the cell, has to have a receptor protein that is on the surface of the cell, or at least part of it is on the surface of the cell. Well, this one is, right? It has the receptor site exposed to the exterior, which is where the signal can get to. And if it binds, it's acting as a ligand. Signals are examples of, even more general, ligands, right? Ligand is anything that can bind to a protein. And what did I tell you happens as a general consequence of a ligand binding to a protein? Right. In every case of a ligand binding to a protein, there is a conformational change, which means a change in the shape of the protein. And this is no different. So if this signal molecule is present and it binds to this receptor, the receptor, which is a protein, will change its shape. Now, if this were an integral protein that is not transmembrane, let's just say it only went through half the thickness, didn't go all the way into the inside, its changing of shape, the cell would never know about, right? Yeah, big deal, it changes shape, but all the stuff inside the cell would have no idea that happened. That's why a receptor for an exterior signal has to be transmembrane, because when it changes shape, that shape change will also include the part that is facing the interior of the cell. That will change shape. And so now notice that the shape had changed. You didn't see the original shape, but now it has the correct shape for this other little purple thing to hook onto it, which wouldn't happen if the signal had not knocked on the door from the outside. And so that's signal transduction. The signal's job is done, the original signal. This is now what's called a second messenger. It's like relaying a note to someone else to deliver it to a third person. Right? The information is being conveyed. But that's what signal transduction is. All right, cell-to-cell recognition in D is what I was talking about earlier when I said these little sugars on the surface of cells act like little ID badges. So you have a glycoprotein here. That's, of course, one protein. The glycoprotein, though, is the protein to which the sugar is directly connected to on this one cell on the bottom. And then another cell has its own protein with a shape that can understand, that can recognize this particular sugar ID. And therefore, this cell knows this cell is one of us. not a foreigner. Similar is intercellular joining. In fact, we've already covered this when I was talking about desmosomes, right? This is just a simplified drawing. It doesn't really show you the shape. But intercellular joining involves a protein that's embedded in one membrane connecting to a protein that's embedded in another cell's membrane, holding the two cells together. And then finally, and also related, you have attachment to the cytoskeleton and extracellular matrix. That's what I was talking about with strain relief earlier. Here you have one transmembrane protein, and the part that sticks outward is attached to proteins that make up the extracellular matrix. And the part of that same transmembrane protein that is facing the interior is connected directly to proteins that make up the cytoskeleton. So if you pull on this, it's going to transmit that pull all the way to the interior of the cell without actually just ripping a hole in the membrane. All right. Slide 9 looks familiar. We've had similar pictures when we were talking about in the tour of the cell, the movement of vesicles from the endoplasmic reticulum to the Golgi complex and to the plasma membrane. That's what we're looking at again here. The only thing that's new here is a visual explanation of how the cell can distinguish between putting proteins that have already been processed and gone through the Golgi into the plasma membrane as part of the plasma membrane versus fully exporting those proteins all the way out of the cell. All right, so you have the vesicle coming out of the Golgi here. Well, let's actually go through the whole steps. The endoplasmic reticulum, first of all, receives the brand new proteins and it appropriately modifies them. That's the job of the endoplasmic reticulum. Once it's modified, then it packages it into a little membrane vesicle from itself, sends it to the Golgi. The Golgi receives it, figures out where it needs to go, and makes new vesicles. Okay, now, you have a vesicle coming down here, and notice that it has different kinds of proteins in it. But some of these proteins that are part of this package are completely inside the vesicle, right? They're not connected to the membrane. They're just inside the membrane, inside the vesicle. This one that kind of looks like a dumbbell, though, is a protein that has been embedded into the vesicle membrane. All right? Reason that makes a difference is when this vesicle fuses to the plasma membrane and becomes part of the plasma membrane, all of the proteins that were completely inside the vesicle will get spilled all the way out. But ones like this dumbbell that are actually part of the vesicle will now become part of the plasma membrane rather than being fully exported. So it's the Golgi that figures that out and either puts them into the membrane or allows them to just be fully inside the vesicle. Now, these next three slides I'm not going to do here. You're going to hear about these today because you have lab today, right? But I don't have time to fit these three slides in the regular lecture time, for one thing. But these are also directly applicable to what you do in lab. So I'm going to do the 10, 11, and 12 downstairs. I just need you to realize that even though it's in a different room, those will be lecture material, so fair game for lecture exam questions. They're, at the same time, though, the stuff I'm going to talk about for these three slides is also lab material, so fair game for the lab quiz. But I'm skipping over them from now because those will be in a separate recording. Let me go to 13 then. This is a single cell, and it specifically, it is not only a unicellular organism, and it is an example of a protist. Now, the word protist, by the way, kind of a catch-all term. A protist isn't necessarily a unicellular organism. Sometimes that word is used that way. That's actually not true. Protist refers to any eukaryote that is not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. Now, some of those are unicellular, some are not. For instance, brown algae can be huge, but they're not. They are a eukaryote, but they're not an animal, a plant, or a fungus, so they're considered protists. This is a unicellular protist, though, that we're looking at. So it's a single-celled organism, and more specifically than that, it is an aquatic protist. Now, what does aquatic mean?
Water.
Right, it means it lives in water, but so do marine organisms. What's the difference between aquatic and marine?
Freshwater.
Right, aquatic refers to freshwater, lakes, streams, and rivers, whereas marine refers to ocean water, salt water. And those are drastically different environments to live in. Well, an aquatic protist, a unicellular aquatic protist, lives in fresh water. And therefore, for reasons that I haven't explained yet, usually I don't get to this slide until after I've already done this lab thing, but because of the rescheduling this term, we haven't had those three slides yet. Anyway, as you'll be fully explained later, an aquatic protist, since it lives in freshwater, faces the situation in which water is continuously trying to enter the cell, and actually does enter the cell continuously. But as if you can imagine water coming into the cell, that's going to swell it up, right? And just like our own cells as animals, this protist does not have a cell wall. It has a flimsy plasma membrane. So it's in danger of exploding. But it can't keep the water out. The water is going to continuously come in because it's a watery environment. And therefore it has this specialized organelle called a contractile vacuole. Vacuole simply means a little empty bag, or looks like it's empty, just like the central vacuole that we talked about earlier for plants, but this is a contractile vacuole because its surface is made out of those microfilaments that are able to work just like our muscles work. So it's able to contract. In other words, it's a little bag that when it fills up to a certain amount will squeeze and push that water back out. It's just doing that continuously, like our heart is continuously beating, but this is more or less a bilge pump, continuously pumping water out to keep it from exploding, which is a big deal because, you know, we explode a few million cells of our blood, can't even tell, because there are millions of cells in an almost invisibly small space of, you know, it's nothing for us, but if you lose the only cell that you have, you're dead. And so that's an important organelle for it. Now we can talk more about transport proteins. Remember, first of all, what I said earlier. A transport protein is some sort of transmembrane protein that is acting as a way for certain materials to get through the membrane, either into the cell or out of the cell. Well, there's a lot of ways that can happen, so there are categories of transport proteins. First of all, a transport protein, hopefully makes sense to you, has to be transmembrane, right? If it weren't transmembrane, it wouldn't be able to get the thing all the way through the thickness. So transport proteins are all transmembrane proteins, but there are, keep in mind, there are the other kinds of transmembrane proteins besides transport proteins. We discussed those when we looked at the six. Well, based on how they work, and not at all based on what they move, not the kinds of particles they move, but just based on how they work, there are two broad categories of transport proteins, and those are shown here: channel proteins and carrier proteins. Each purple thing is a transport protein. A channel protein is simply a tunnel. We're looking at a cutaway view here, so you can see the tunnel aspect of it, but just like that ribbon model I showed you earlier, that was a channel protein. And as you would expect for a tunnel, anything that isn't too big or doesn't have anything that can fit through there, basically, will be able to go through. A channel, in other words, just allows things through it without actually interacting with them. It's just a passageway. Now, there are such things as non-gated channels, which we see here. There's no gates. And there are ones that are gated, so that the channel itself doesn't change shape, but at one end or the other, it can have a gate. Those are still channel proteins, though. If a channel is open, and if the right kind of thing is present, then they can move through the channel. A carrier protein, on the other hand, does change shape when it operates, unlike a channel protein. Channel protein doesn't change shape other than the gate, if it has one. A carrier protein has to change shape for it to operate, though, because it's not a tunnel all the way through. It has a binding site on it for temporary binding of just the right kind of thing. And as I keep repeating, if you have something bind to a protein, it's going to change shape, right? In the case of a carrier protein, the shape change is such that it will open up onto the other side of the membrane, either out or in, depending on which way it is. In this case, it's open outside first, and then when it binds, it opens inward and allows that thing to it lets go of that solute particle and allows it now to be inside the cell. So that's the big distinction. Carrier proteins operate by changing conformation, whereas channel proteins do not change conformation. It's the tunnel is keeps the same shape. Okay, now 15. What we're looking at here is just one example of what is called a pump. Pumps are transport proteins, but not all transport proteins are pumps. The transport proteins that we call pumps are ones that operate via active transport. All right, so there's three major transport mechanisms that can get things into and out of cells. And I mentioned this the last time, although I didn't explain all three. I mentioned it at the time because one of those three categories of transport processes is vesicular transport that we did talk about, right? Endocytosis, exocytosis, that's all vesicular transport. That's one way in which you can get things either into or out of the cell. Namely, using a vesicle. There are then two other categories, which are active transport and passive transport. Those don't involve vesicles. And one distinction between those two, as opposed to vesicular transport, is that vesicular transport is kind of like cheating. Because if you think about it, something that's moved via vesicular transport, either into or out of the cell, never actually goes through a membrane, right? You surround it. If it's endocytosis, for instance, The plasma membrane surrounds that thing and then seals off on the other end. It never went through a membrane, right? Now it's in a vesicle inside the cell, but it never went through the plasma membrane. On the other hand, active transport and passive transport, things actually move through the membrane. Not necessarily directly through the phospholipid bilayer, maybe through a transmembrane protein instead, but it's through the membrane. They share that. Active and passive have that in common. But what makes them different, and therefore different categories, is that passive transport does not require expenditure of additional energy. It requires energy, but the energy that drives it is already there in the built into the system. And therefore, it can happen on its own. Active transport, on the other hand, will never happen unless you supply an outside source of energy, which is often ATP, and you can see ATP being used here, but it doesn't have to be ATP. It just has to be some external source of energy. Without supplying that energy, active transport is never going to work. It's just not going to happen, I mean. All right, so I'll go through this particular pump in detail later, but that's enough for now. I'll see you in class.